This podcast examines issues on violence driven by gender inequality, a global health problem that is likely to have personally touched the lives of our listeners. Do take care while listening and email svri at svri.org for resources.
Over the years, some of the biggest organizations in the humanitarian sector have had to answer to allegations of sexual misconduct and abuse of power by their staff. In fact, it seems that no one organization is untouched.
It took years to shed light on these allegations, as there are many reasons why people might hesitate to come forward. So the question is, how can we do better for the victims and for the humanitarian sector as a whole?
Welcome to the Sexual Violence Research Podcast from the SVRI. I am Elizabeth Dartnell.
And I'm Aisha Margo. Our vision is to see a world free of violence against women and violence against children. And in this podcast, we learn how to make that vision a reality.
In today's episode, we are asking, how can we guarantee the safety of our staff and the people that we are meant to serve? Sexual misconduct and abuse of power in the humanitarian sector is still incredibly taboo to bring up. The implications on the reputation and funding of these organizations can be catastrophic.
And the lifelong consequences on the victims and the witnessing staff cannot be underplayed either. So, while reporting tools and policies have and are being developed, what barriers and challenges are we still facing in this area? And are we still in need of a larger culture change in the sector? To answer these questions, we are joined by two guests. Tessie San Martin, current CEO of FHI 360, before which she spent more than a decade as CEO and president of Plan International USA, and Theodora Suter, acting head of the Prevention of Sexual Exploitation, Abuse and Harassment at the IOM, the UN's International Organization for Migration. So Tessie, let's start with you. Based on your experience, why is it so difficult for us to speak about sexual exploitation and abuse within humanitarian agencies?
I mean, look, for organizations, it's difficult for many reasons. One is, you know, obviously fear of litigation. There is a fear of reputational damage and its effects on funding. If I can just share one quick anecdote. This was some years ago, and it was after those scandals that rocked our sector in, I guess, was it 18? And, you know, the organization for which I worked at the time, Plan International USA, we were in line to receive, had already been told we're going to be getting, you know, a good size grant from an individual donor in the United States. But, you know, as we were expecting the letter and the check, we instead got a note from the donor that said, look, Plan International has published a report on incidents of safeguarding. I do not feel that I can, at this time, make the donation to the organization. For us, part of the interesting aspect of this letter was that the report was not one that Plan International USA had made. It was a report that Plan International UK had made. But it doesn't matter to the donor. Whether it's Plan International US, Plan International UK, it's all Plan International. And I think that makes theme for me that an issue anywhere in the sector is an issue for everyone in the sector, right? It's a risk across the board, not just for the organizations that are reporting the incident. So that's, you know, organizationally, institutionally. I think for individuals, right, for survivors, the difficulties and the barriers are so many, fear of being retaliated against, embarrassment, fear of being arrested, because sometimes, right, some of the issues that are being reported entail behaviors that in some places are, you know, illegal against the law. In any case, I think talking about sexual activity, sexual exploitation and abuse in many contexts is taboo and highly stigmatized. So there's so many barriers to talking about these issues. We need to acknowledge what those barriers are and then think of ways to address those barriers, make it easier for individuals, make it more compelling for organizations, you know, and donors.
Yeah, there are many barriers. And as you say, if we don't diagnose the problem properly, we aren't ever going to really address it. You've worked both in Plan International and now at FHI 360, have you seen significant key differences in attitudes or approaches to safeguarding since you first started working at Plan International in the USA in 2010? And what might some of those be?
Well, so great question. But actually, let me go back to before I was at Plan International. And I'll tell you a quick story. So I was in Bosnia. I was working in Bosnia after the war. I was working for PricewaterhouseCoopers. We had a contract with USAID. And so I was in Sarajevo and in Bosnia-Herzegovina, you know, quite a bit. Sometime in 1997 or 98, the stories began to be told about a USAID contractor that had been caught in the activity of sex trafficking. And it was interesting, reflecting on this conversation we were going to have, I was thinking about how we dealt with that particular issue at that point in time. And, you know, I think the first thing to note it was something that was being whispered, not something that was being talked out loud. It's like, oh, well, this happened. And by the way, I hear it was, you know, the chief of party was involved and people in the project. And so the conversations were, wow, this is like, you know, terrible. What an awful thing to be happening, right? In a place where the population is already traumatized after the war. But also an attitude of, well, you know, I guess that's what's going to happen. Almost a strange acceptance that that's what was going to happen. When you have these, you know, power imbalances, when you're working in these types of environments. So I think one of the big things that has changed for me, you know, being in the sector all this time is the willingness to talk out loud about it, what we were saying earlier, and to move beyond the, well, that's what's going to happen, to this cannot happen. It is objectively an awful thing, and we need to discuss it. We need to deal with it as a sector, and we need to be transparent about it. It can't just be something that's whispered and talked about on the side. In Plan International USA, so it's a child sponsorship organization. And so as such, I have to say that since I first arrived there, I guess it was 2010, right? So already some years beyond that, safeguarding was front and center for sponsorship, for child sponsorship, right? Because that connection between the sponsor and the child is a wonderful thing. In an era of digital communication, social media, and so on, it creates all kinds of additional risks for the children. So Plan International was very focused on safeguarding, but in the context of child sponsorship. I think when the various scandals came to light in our sector in, you know, I think it was 2018, I can't remember the exact date, but, you know, what that did for us and for the whole sector was kind of elevate the issue. For us, we said safeguarding isn't just an issue pertaining to child sponsorship as a specific giving product and communication with the donor. It's an issue across all the work that Plan International in every country does. And by the way, it's an issue within Plan International as well. So the elevation of the issue, and again, this willingness to talk about the issue is a big, in my opinion, a big sea change in our industry and, you know, long overdue, right?
How serious do you see humanitarian organizations taking this issue in your view? And do you see there's a difference between humanitarian organizations and maybe development agencies?
To answer your second question first, is there a difference? I don't think so, because the dynamics are the same. Are there differences for organizations depending on how they're funded? That might be an issue, right? Because there is a question of donor accountability. And we spoke earlier, right, about the donor who decided to not give us at Plan a donation based on reporting. But, you know, but this idea that donors, that certain donors are looking closely and maybe some are not. But I don't know. You know, I there's an awful lot we don't know about safeguarding, even about what works in safeguarding. There hasn't been much research on, you know, sort of best practices and the effectiveness of the same. Equally, right, do we know, are there real differences based on observable evidence about differences of responses and how are those related to how organizations are funded? I don't know. I mean, I can tell you there was an interesting moment after the scandals, that rocked Oxfam and Save the Children, the CEOs of Plan Save, Care, Oxfam, Mercy Corps, International Medical Corps, there were a variety, Médecins Sans Frontières, the CEOs of the U.S. entities that were part of those federated, mostly federated structures, had been meeting together on a variety of issues. When those scandals emerged, those CEOs met. I remember we met in New York to discuss just this issue and to discuss what we could do as U.S.-based entities to advance safeguarding in our sector. Now, you can see some of those organizations were more development, some were more humanitarian. I think one of the things that all of us shared is we had a large base of individual donors. We had a large base of private donors, not just, government or, sort of official bilateral, multilateral donors. So that's why I'm wondering if there's a, if there's a difference. But it was interesting. So we got together to discuss how we might be able to advance things in our sector. And the reason why we were discussing this as U.S.-based entities is you will recall that at the time, the U.K. government took some fairly, stringent measures and took action against those two organizations. And I think it was only recently that Save the Children in the U.K. was allowed to take U.K. government money again. So the UK government was being very proactive. They created a whole commission, a lot of requirements for these organizations. None of that was happening in the US. And it was the UK government and the Charities Commission that really began to adopt some pretty clear standards for safeguarding in the sector, but as it pertained to organizations that were taking UK government money. And by the way, it's only recently that the U.S. government, that USAID, has come out with standards, which I had personally been advocating for. So I guess a couple of things. One is, I think maybe the donors matter and donors' attention matter and sort of demanding that type of accountability. At the end of the day, also the things that really matters the most is the CEOs, right? Because on these things, the tone truly is set at the top. And, CEO, chief executive commitment, understanding of the importance of these issues, understanding of the responsibilities that we have to the communities with which we engage, where we work, and to creating a culture of transparency and accountability, that welcomes discussions on these issues and creates the safety to be able to talk about them. I think the CEOs matter a lot. In the U.S., the members of Interaction, which is the umbrella group for INGOs here in the U.S., the CEOs have the option of signing the CEO pledge to protect against sexual exploitation, abuse, and harm. It is an option. It's not a requirement to be a member. But, as an Interaction member, myself and others like to, at gatherings, talk about these issues and get other CEOs, engaged in these conversations. So I think the tone at the top does matter as well.
So Tessie, in addition to what you've mentioned, creating the safe spaces, starting from the top, having this culture of transparency, what else would you add in terms of the cultural shifts we need to see in this sector? And what do you think are the major challenges and obstacles on the way?
Yes. And the reason I say that culture and tone matter is because safeguarding can just be a compliance issue, right? And then, we've got like policies, procedures, and we have all of that. The question is, what are we doing with it? And you can tick all the boxes, but not really get the type of, effect that you want in terms of both preventing these types of incidents, but also responding quickly and firmly when they happen. And that's more than just, that's more than just compliance. Now, what is required for that? I think, first of all, is what we were talking about earlier, just a willingness to be able to talk about it, that this is an issue, that this is an issue for our organization and everywhere. I think we also have to we have to have a variety of avenues for people to be able to report and do so safely. So one channel is not enough. Constant communication, constant training, constant reminders, constant gathering so people can exchange, you know, lessons learned. There isn't one silver bullet. It's just a variety of actions that reinforce what we're about, and particularly that this is not just a compliance issue. This is really about values. This is about ethics. This is about, you know, morality, and not just what must be done, but why it's the right thing to do. I also think that there's some actions. Yeah, so for example, one of the things that we finally did, which is a requirement of the CEO pledge, is we're finally now publishing on an annual basis our own incident report. That took a while to get there, you know, because, well, you know, we're a big organization and there's a legal thing and there's all kinds of, you know, things about that. But I think it was important for the organization to see that we had done that, right? That we, that the management of the organization is willing to acknowledge the incidents that we've had and that we're willing to do that. All that being said, I think it's probably fair to say in our organization, we've got a safeguarding committee. We get together, you know, once a quarter. We're monitoring consistently, you know, incidents being reported, investigated, and so on. I don't know that for an organization of our size, I have a sense that we may still see underreporting. And that just kind of tells you this is a long, hard slog. It isn't like, oh, you know, we're, you know, please come forward. And what I think there is a whole set of things that have to, that start, yes, with clear directives, clear standards, clear accountabilities, a whole system for reporting, a whole system and staff and expertise for investigating, and do so in a proper way that, you know, acknowledges privacy issues and so on, and always has in mind, right, the safety of the survivors. So there's a whole infrastructure that has to be developed and then continuously reinforced. And that answers your second question, which, you know, what's a barrier? Money. It takes some resources to develop this infrastructure, to develop this, you know, muscle in the organization. It's not that it's hugely expensive and it's going to be millions of dollars, but, you know, our organizations are constantly watching, you know, your overhead and what's not going directly to programming. And so this is like risk management, but this is essential, right? And I do think it's an essential investment that we need to make. I guess the other thing I would say is, you know, organizations don't need to reinvent the wheel. There's a lot that we have learned over the last many years where people have been, you know, organizations have been more willing to come forward. There are all kinds of opportunities and seminars to share experiences, all kinds of training modules that are available. So organizations that want to do this can avail themselves of all kinds of material that is now available that I don't think was as available before. There are also some other instruments that are interesting. You know, one of the things that I'm most proud of that we finally joined is the misconduct disclosure scheme, which is a scheme that allows the organizations that have joined that to share with each other whether folks that are going to be hired by the organization have a history of, you know, sexual abuse and so on. I can tell you that group of CEOs that met in New York, we discussed this, and then we brought our general counsels to discuss it, and there were nothing but barriers to the idea of how do you make sure that folks that have a history in this area do not get hired and rehired and rehired. And you can imagine, right, all kinds of questions about, like, liability and libel, but there is a way to do this. The, you know, misconduct disclosure scheme, you know, demonstrate that it can be done with willing members. So there's more instruments now available that are not particularly taxing for organizations. So it's just an encouragement to colleagues across the sector. If you're not investing sufficiently in safeguarding, it's a problem not just for you, but for me. So it's an ask from me to everyone in the sector to please take this seriously, please invest, and please ask for help, because those of us who have been at this longer have all kinds of resources that we're willing to share.
Let's turn to Theodora now. As mentioned, Theodora is the Acting Head of Prevention of Sexual Exploitation, Abuse, and Harassment at the IOM. There, Theodora supervised the creation of IOM's new Prevention on Sexual Exploitation and Abuse strategy, as well as the organization's platform to report allegations of misconduct.
IOM has created the We Are All In platform, and you have been an integral part of that. Can you just tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so when we started thinking about developing a platform, we were looking at our data in terms of reports, and we were observing that we were getting very little numbers, so people were not comfortable reporting, it seemed, based on the data. So instead of thinking, oh, this is great and everything is okay in IOM, we started thinking, what are we doing wrong that people do not feel comfortable reporting? And then we assessed that internally through an internal assessment, so to speak, and we found a lot of reasons why IOM staff did not feel comfortable reporting. The fact that they didn't trust the internal system, they thought that if reports are coming in, it takes too long to be addressed, nothing is happening, it's too complicated, and so on. So a set of questions. So it became evident that we needed to respond to these very negative perceptions. I'm not saying they were all right, all wrong, but they were the perception of the staff. So they were taking a picture of the situation, and we needed to respond to those perceptions. And one of the things that the organization put in place was this We Are All In platform. The idea was that we wanted to create a one door where people, well, IOM staff and eventually beneficiary, but it was when it was developed really tailored to IOM staff, could go and seek for more information about misconduct, self-educate themselves about what does it mean reporting, what are the obligation, how the process works, but also be able to report in two clicks. So the We Are All In was really one door where you get everything. You don't need to speak with anybody. This is between you and the platform. So it can be used in a very private matter. It respects totally the confidentiality. It actually doesn't store data. It just passes data to the relevant department. And so that was really the idea. But it was successful not because, I mean, one platform did not solve the issue. It came together with renovated effort on capacity building, a lot of awareness raising material, and always telling them, you don't need to report to remember definitions. If there is something wrong, remember, we are all in. This is your place. This is where you should be going. The other thing I would like to add is that platform is, available in different languages. It's also has been developing using a user-friendly kind of perspective. So it's very easy to navigate, even if you are not tech savvy. Yeah, and then it's very secure, basically.
I mean, it's clear that it's an amazing platform that actually has a lot of features so that people can use it easily, so that they feel safe using it. But what's the response been from humanitarian agencies, from other agencies about this platform?
So this is an IOM platform, so it's an internal tool. So in terms of reaction from the other organization, I think it was welcome. It was one of the first tailored platform on misconduct. But since then, a lot of other agencies have developed something along the same lines. So I think there are also some details that are important. Before the We Are All In platform, we in IOM, we were not accepting anonymous reports, which we saw was one of the main blockages for not reporting. This is now allowed by the platform. So there were a lot of, again, ways to tweak the reporting mechanism, considering the negative perceptions that we had found among staff.
That's actually very interesting, though I guess anonymous reporting is also another sort of really difficult and challenging area within the sexual harassment field and, in the corporate world and in other sectors as well. So in terms of the We Are All In platform, we know that coordinators, PSEA coordinators, have reported that in some of the different organizations, some of the biggest challenges they've had are the trivializing and the denial that sexual exploitation and abuse actually exists in their sector. And then that obviously comes along with a culture of silence, underreporting. Just from a personal perspective and from your experience in the field, what is your view on these things?
I think now it's very clear that this is a priority, like we are really serious in terms of PSEA. Now, how this gets unpacked, it's another question, because it is true that sometimes, as Tessie was saying, it's more a tick-the-box exercise, like head of agencies are just making sure that training is delivered, but then they don't necessarily come to the training. So that creates a whole very negative message to the staff, as others are saying that because there are no reports, it means this is not happening. So of course, there are a lot still, unfortunately, managers that do not recognize the gravity or think it's not, it does not apply in their operational context. For example, now, just coming from the Ukraine emergency operation, it was evident that from the outset of the emergency, PSEA was given very high priority by all the agencies. There were interagency coordinator placed in every country. Every agency appointed focal points. But then it depends again. For us, for example, we made sure our focal points spoke the local language, were actually familiar with the context, so that when they were working on capacity building, they would understand better how to explain these things. Because you need to be very careful when you try to pass the message about PSEA, to unpack it so that it makes sense to people, because otherwise it remains a kind of, yes, yes, you have this kind of reaction. Yes, yes, but, you know, this is not relevant to me. So you need to unpack it in a way that makes sense to the people receiving it. And in a way for me, and I'm like, I have trained a lot of people around the world, my target group are the ones that are not taking these issues seriously, because they are a minority, but they are the people we should be targeting in the UN system. A lot of our colleagues are on board and they know this is not okay. They know they are aware of the power they have because of their position. They know that they have to report. But I'm interested to go and look for the one that still are doubting about this. In a way, the most difficult one, but the one we should be targeting it. And when you manage to get them at the end of your training, questioning maybe some of their behavior, then this is a success.
I want to pick up on exactly that you've said, and talk about that thing about power and the enormous power imbalance that's often at play in emergency contexts, in humanitarian contexts, and obviously between aid workers and those that they serve. So as you said, how do you get them? How do you cultivate that culture of respect? What are the things you found that do work, or, you know, lessons that you've learned that are positive in that context of how to do that?
I mean, it is, again, something quite challenging, because also the way in which we react to power is very personal and very culturally connotated, you know, so there is not one answer that will address all this. But I think through capacity building, I mean, there are some exercises that really unpack the power dynamics and make them realize where do they stand. And there is this famous power walk where, you know, physical people that have a position power come forward while the people of concern somehow stay back. This is a very kind of experiential exercise where people sometimes for the first time realize the power they have. But more than that, what they sometimes lack is the fact that how often do they look back to see the people that didn't move and why these people didn't move. And then you need to then make them step into the shoe of the victim and ask them, how easy it would be for you if you were at the back of the room to come forward and to tell us something is wrong. Maybe you are scared. Maybe you don't speak the language. Maybe you have had a very traumatic past experience. Maybe you think that this is the only way you will get services. So these type of exercises, I believe, are one of the best way to make people, all people, realize the power position they have. Now, having said that, I think it's also interesting to look at the discussion you have on unpacking this concept, because again, in every country, this exercise will result very different. In some countries, the police is even before the UN worker. In other countries, the grandmother taking care of orphans is on the first line. So it's very interesting also to understand how this is perceived at the local level. I think this is one important point. The other point, of course, is the culture of the organization. It has to come from the top. It's so important that they see that this is relevant for everyone, whether you are the chief of mission or the driver. This is something that does not depend from you. It's a rule and that's it. And it's important to understand why. So this is also super important, I would say. And without that, it will be difficult to really transform this perspective.
Thanks to our guests, Tessie San Martin and Theodora Suter.
We've lined up loads more incredible speakers for the rest of this new series. So please make sure to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss an episode. I am Elizabeth Dartnell.
And I'm Aisha Margot. And you've been listening to the Sexual Violence Research Podcast by the SVRI. To find out more about our work and our vision, visit www.svri.org.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
This podcast is produced by OG Podcasts. Find out more at ogpodcasts.co.uk.